Smith, you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Shortly before the lunch break, Mr. Chief Justice Berger posed the question as to whether or not, in the absence of a Section 1988 authorization for attorney's fees in the present matter, the respondents would be able to collect attorney's fees if they prevail. The answer to that question is no. There is no provision in the state of Maine under a fact situation as we have before us for the authorization of the award of attorney's fees. However, we would say that this certainly does not place the respondents necessarily in a different category from other persons in this country who are serving or seeking to obtain legal services. Also, there's the pro bono aspect of legal work. And finally, there is the legal aid societies, which have been in effect for several years in this country. Your petitioner was stating that the purposes of the Civil Rights Act, as shown by the enactors and legislators pursuant to its predecessor, the Civil Rights Act of 1871, was basically to enforce the 14th Amendment provisions and other rights and to prevent further trampling of those rights by the Ku Klux Klan. In fact,
were the words and laws in the original statute?
No, sir, they were not. They were.
When did they come in?
They came in 1874 pursuant to the revised draft.
And what do you suppose they were supposed to cover?
The petitioner claims, Your Honor, that the and laws provision was to relate to the Act of 1866, the laws contained therein, as well as the 14th Amendment provisions, equal rights and civil rights, but not the Social Security Act, without a violation of some due process, equal protection, discriminatory action.
Well, specifically,
on behalf of the state.
To what kind of laws do you suggest the statute was limited?
Well, if I may give an example, for example.
Well, I mean, is there a label you can give it? Civil rights laws or something like that?
Let's see, civil rights laws, equal rights laws.
Yeah.
Where one starts and the other stops, I'm not sure myself.
But none of those words, those modifiers are not in the statute, is it?
They are not within the
today.
No, sir. The statute says and laws. However, as this Court is well aware, it has been interpreted by concurring opinions in the Chapman decision to encompass equal rights, as it has also been interpreted in
only
a concurring opinion not to.
Is that a suggested limitation upon the kinds of law?
Two or three members of the Court in the Chapman case, in a separate opinion,
yes, sir,
expressed the pretty unambiguous view that laws meant what it said, didn't they?
Yes, sir.
And specifically that they included the Social Security Act.
Just as the three members stated the opposite.
Yes. Although the Chapman case involved not 1983 directly, but 1343, didn't it?
Yes, sir, and the jurisdictional aspect. Here, again, we don't have problems with the respondents obtaining what relief they're seeking in the absence of 1983. Your petitioner also asserts.
Well, I thought you said earlier, though, that without 1983, there's no authority for counsel fees.
For counsel fees, no, sir. But as far as the relief which respondents sought and received, 1983 was superfluous. It was not necessary.
But if law is in 1983, if we should constitute that to mean just what it says, laws, and specifically Social Security laws, then I gather there's a basis for a 1988 counsel fee.
Yes, no doubt about it.
And that's really what we have to decide.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor. The state would also refer to the majority opinion in Chapman and state that one purpose, again, of the Congress in the Act of 1871 was to ensure a right of action to enforce the protections of the 14th Amendment and the federal laws enacted pursuant thereto. And it is petitioner's firm assertion that the Social Security Act was not a law that was enacted pursuant to the Civil Rights Act. In fact, taking into consideration the passions and events of the time, the Reconstruction Day era, Your petitioners find it difficult to believe the legislators, drafters, or revisers could have contemplated a good faith error in computation of welfare benefits to be a violation of civil rights or the Constitution and laws as they knew them at that time.
Well, there weren't any Social Security benefits at that time.
That's correct, Your Honor. If there had been, and if people had been deprived of benefits pursuant to a discriminatory action because of their race, their ethnic background, such, we'd say it would apply, but not under the facts in this case.
But there certainly were Social Security benefits at the time the Civil Rights Attorney's Fees
Most
Act
definitely.
Was enacted in 76.
Yes, sir. However, it's the state's contention that Section 1988 would not apply to the violations in this case before the bench. This is predicated upon two main assertions. The first is that the Civil Rights Attorney's Fees Awards Act was based upon 14th Amendment violations. The second is predicated upon the lack of specific statutory authorization, as we believe was mandated by the Alyeska pipeline decision. Now, in Hudo v. Finney, this court awarded attorney's fees, but they awarded attorney's fees pursuant to violations of both the 8th and the 14th Amendment, either of which are at issue herein. In Fitzpatrick, we had a discrimination claim. We do not have any discrimination in this case. Since 1866, Congress has seen fit to enact over 50 statutes to provide for attorney's fees, but they have not done so regarding the Social Security Act except in limited areas. One of those areas was Section 406B1, which I believe was amended in 1966, 1968, and dealt with disability claims. Had Congress seen fit to specifically authorize the award of attorney's fees for a good faith violation in computing of benefits, it is petitioner's assertion that they surely would have done so and made it more plain than is made in the ambiguous history of that act as gleaned through the record as well as through the debates. Once more, the wording of the act is that in the discretion of a court, and if a party prevails on a civil rights 1983 among other civil rights claims, and if it's a proceeding or action to enforce a provision of Section 1983, attorney's fees would be proper. Once again, this was not an action to enforce a provision of 1983, as petitioners assert. The respondents have argued that the plain meaning theory would prevent any research into the history of Section 1983 prior to the revised statutes of 1979. The state would counter this by saying that throughout the opinions, concurring opinions and dissenting opinions in Chapman, we believe that the court has already gone beyond the revised statutes in 1874 and recognized that delving into the history prior to 1874 is indeed necessary. There are other cases in which the court has also gone into the background of 1983 before the revision of 1874. One of those cases was District of Columbia versus Carter. The other was Examining Board versus Otero de Flores. The respondents have not considered Section 1983 in light of the events and passions of the times in which it was enacted. For this reason, we believe that their arguments that the and laws provision applies must be denied. Finally, the state, while reserving some time for rebuttal, I would like to make brief mention of its third argument having to do with exclusive jurisdiction. The state alleges that the state court does not have authority to hear Section 1983 claim in a state court. This was brought to bear in the state court of Maine. We brought it forward for this court for the disposition.
What do you do with the Martinez against California case?
I'm not aware of that case, Your Honor.
It said specifically you could. A state court could.
Oh, excuse me. I believe that an issue reserved in there was whether or not the states must hear. In reading that case, the state does not, I guess the state would contest that it strictly and solely held that, and that it precluded this argument. Our argument is basically that if one were to look at the specific words of the Act of 1871, we would find that the district and civil court, the district and circuit courts were given jurisdiction to the exclusion of the state courts, as well as the legislative history and the purposes of the Act, when state courts were indeed violating many of the civil rights which the Acts of 1866 and 1871 were passed to enforce. For these reasons, the state would ask this court to overturn the decision of the Maine Supreme Judicial Court, and specifically to state that the Social Security Act is not within the provisions of Section 1983.
Now, what the Maine Supreme Court did is to remand this case to the trial court, didn't it?
They did, sir, for the sole purpose of
exercising his jurisdiction, but upon the hypothesis that 1988 was applicable.
Yes, sir, for a determination of attorney's fees. The lower court did not state why it denied attorney's fees.
Right.
That was the purpose for the remand.
But so far as now appears, the trial court may still deny attorney's fees.
That's quite correct, sir. Yes.
As a matter of discretion.
As a matter of discretion.
The Supreme Court of Maine has said that the authority is there, has it not?
Yes, sir.
In this opinion.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I have two major points that I would like to make on behalf of the respondents.
Would you raise your voice a little, Mr. Mitchell?
I will. The first of those major points is that over many years, this Court has given all of the civil rights statutes a broad reading. And the second major point deals with the plain meaning of Section 1983 as it now reads. Turn first to what this court has done in United States versus Price and in Griffin versus Breckinridge. It said quite clearly that all of the Reconstruction civil rights statutes were to be read broadly and literally. And following that instruction, this court has over the last 12 years reached a number of decisions in Section 1983 Social Security Act cases. And in each of those cases, there was before this court a claim for relief which had to turn on Section 1983. Two of those cases bear a particular note. The first is Rosado versus Wyman, and the second is Edelman versus Jordan. Now, Rosado is important because by the time that case came to this court, there was no constitutional claim of any kind remaining in the case. In fact, the constitutional claim had dropped out several years previously in the district court, and in fact, even prior to a remand, if that's the proper word, from the three-judge court to Judge Weinstein. This court reached and decided the statutory claim, and the only possible cause of action that the plaintiffs in that case could have asserted was based on Section 1983. What had been done in Rosado was later specifically recognized and accepted in Edelman, albeit in dicta. Edelman was, of course, about retroactive benefits. But in the course of that opinion, both the majority and one of the dissenting opinions specifically recognized what had happened in Rosado and specifically stated that the cause of action that was before this court was the statutory 1983 cause of action. The second point is that, as our brief points out, this is a case for the application of the traditional primary rule of statutory construction. One looks to the plain meaning of the statute and applies it, unless there is some very clear and convincing reason, initially, on the face of the statute, to not do so. And in this case, looking at this statute, there is no ambiguity on its face of any kind that permits the insertion of modifying or limiting words. I should point out here that there are, of course, a range of cases involving federal statutes where Section 1983 actions cannot be brought. First and foremost, there must be defendants who are acting under color of state law. Second, Congress can, either expressly or impliedly, preclude federal courts from entertaining Section 1983 statutory causes of action. We discuss that point in some more detail in footnote 12 of our brief. But once those two major exceptions fall by the wayside, we are then left with a very clear, very plain, very unambiguous statute.
Well, except there still remains, unless I've missed something you've said, one more issue, it seems to me. Even if you're correct that 1983 embraces claims of violations of the Social Security Act, and even if you're correct that such claims under 1983 can be brought in state courts which have concurrent jurisdiction, there still remains the question, does there not, of whether or not Section 1988, which was enacted in response to the Alyeska opinion in this court, which had to do only with the practice of federal courts in awarding attorney's fees, is applicable at all to attorney's fees in state courts.
Well, we do have...
Even assuming the first two questions are answered yes, that you're correct.
The answer to the...
The 1983 action can be brought in a state court, that a 1983 action embraces a violation of the Social Security Act, but nonetheless, the question remains, does 1988 apply to attorney's fees, the award of attorney's fees to the prevailing party in a state court, by contrast to the federal court?
The answer to that question, Your Honor, is yes, it
well,
does.
Well, that's an issue, though, isn't it?
It certainly is.
I mean, that's a remaining issue, even if you're right on the first two.
That's correct. That is one of the questions that the Maine Supreme Judicial Court reached and resolved unanimously in favor.
I know that, but the case is here now.
Oh, yes.
And that is one of the issues, is it not?
No doubt. And the way I would address that issue is by saying several things. First, again, looking to the plain language of the statute, it applies in all courts.
But it is true as a historic matter of fact, is it not, that the enactment of 1988 was in direct response to this court's decision in the Alyeska case?
Oh, yes. There's
it's
no
further
doubt
true
about
that the Alyeska case had to do only with federal courts, is it
except
not?
For footnote 31, I believe that's correct.
And what did footnote 31 say?
Footnote 31 addressed the question of whether or not a state attorney's fee provision, statutory or otherwise, was substantive and would be applied by a federal court in a diversity action.
Yeah.
There is also...
That's a little bit different.
Yes, I realize that. But in terms of looking to whether the Fees Act applies in state courts, one can, if one wishes then, look beyond the plain meaning of the Act itself and look here to a very clear and very unambiguous legislative history.
But, Counsel, let me get you back a moment, if I may, to the first part of your answer to my brother Stewart's question. Your Supreme Judicial Court rejected in terms, did it not, that attorney's fees were recoverable under state law for this kind of thing. It said it had to be 1988 or nothing.
That's right.
In part one of its opinion, because the state of Maine hadn't waived its sovereign immunity.
No question about that, Your Honor. The history of this statute, though, is also plain. And there are several indications, which we've cited in our brief, one speech by Father Drynan, who was here this morning, indicating that the Act was to apply in both state and federal courts. And this court has held in Sullivan that it does apply in state courts, although that decision focused on the first sentence of Section 1988, which has been in place since the revised statutes were enacted in 1874. It stands to reason, though,
That's the first sentence is the one that borrows from state law?
Yes. The long sentence explaining what remedies are to be applied.
Right, and the Sullivan opinion was rendered before the enactment of the present 1988, was it not?
That's correct. Well, the present 1988 is nothing but an additional sentence attached to the original Act. Now, the other reason, though, to look to applying the second sentence, the Fees Act, if you will, in state court, is that in many states, Maine being one, it's a long, long way to the federal court for people in the northern part of the state.
Where you are.
Oh, yes. And if people are to retain counsel of their choosing and to bring cases in a straightforward statutory fashion, they should be able to do that in state court. They should not have to, if they don't want to, go to federal court. And while we believe that in this case a constitutional claim may very well have been made and may very well have passed the Higgins test, there seemed no reason to do that.
Of course, we've rejected the same argument when made from the different, from an opposite side, in the sense that you must have a counsel for a person charged with a misdemeanor who may get a prison sentence in a very large state where there may be 12 or 14 counties. There's going to be a very great burden on the state to supply counsel or a magistrate or that sort of thing. We've said that doesn't make any difference, that if the right is there, it's there. And I would think that by inverse logic, the same is true here.
Well, the problem, I suppose, in terms of focusing on the right is that in Chapman, this Court has indicated that the federal district court may not have jurisdiction over many of these cases. And the only point I'm trying to make is that rather than in some cases go without and in other cases strain to resolve the problem that one is left with after Chapman and with Higgins, why not just turn to the Superior Court?
Well, but in some of the western states, thinly populated, the prosecution's option is frequently to just go without and prosecuting a misdemeanor case where they might want a prison term of 6 months or 1 month or whatever it may be, simply because there aren't enough resources there.
I understand that.
Mr. Middle, you mentioned in some of these cases no federal jurisdiction. I take it there'd be no federal jurisdiction in this case, this very case.
Well, if we had filed the complaint as we have it here, there certainly would not be.
Yeah.
What I suggested, I believe,
you suggested
to Mr. Justice,
you might have
right.
Drafted a constitutional claim of some kind.
No question.
The court noted probable jurisdiction of this appeal.
This was a certiorari petition.
I see, and granted certiorari.
Yes, sir.
This clearly isn't a final judgment, is it?
Well, let me say this. We are not certain. We think it is, and I can tell you why.
Attorney's fees may or may not be awarded. We don't know.
If you look at the Act and you look at the history of the Act and you look at the way that it has been interpreted by a number of circuit courts, you see that while indeed the language of the Supreme Judicial Court leaves open, quote, unquote, the discretion of the Superior Court, I do not see how that court could exercise its discretion in any fashion other than to award fees.
Well, you don't see how, but other people might.
Well, I understand that. But secondly, this case is not unlike any other case where, after the judgment here, there will be, seeing things my way for a moment, nothing left to do but to award costs.
Well, if the trial judge does on remand award costs, the state might bring the question, depending on how we deal with it here, might bring the underlying question back here.
They might. I'm not sure that under state law they can. That's one of the exceptions to the final judgment rule, which is somewhat riddled with exceptions that this court talks about in Cox Broadcasting versus Cohen. There's a main case that may raise some doubts as to their ability to do that.
All exception now, isn't it?
Just about. I mean, as I read Cox Broadcasting, and especially footnote 7, I'm not sure I want to say it's left to the unreviewable discretion of this court, but it is. And there seems to be no real hard, fast rule in any direction. There's another point, I think, that I might make about the statute and the Fees Act in particular. And that is, contrary to the assertion that the state is making, somewhat silently, the Fees Act was enacted not to benefit attorneys, but to benefit the people, and to enable them to obtain counsel and to be able to litigate their valid claims. And that without the Fees Act, many, many cases involving many, many justifiable claims will go unremedied. And that is the purpose of the Act. That's what both the Senate and the House reports say, and that's what is made clear in the floor debates.
Of course, every law is always enacted in the public interest in the view of Congress that enacts it, isn't it?
I think that could be stated with some certainty.
And I'm sure Congress would so state if asked.
Yes. No question, Your Honor.
Often went unasked.
Probably. If the Court has no further questions, then, the respondents would only ask that the judgment of the Maine Supreme Judicial Court be affirmed. Thank you.
Very well, Mr. Mittal. Do you have anything further, Mr. Smith?
Very briefly, sir. May it please the Court. Regarding Mr. Justice Stewart's question about the finality of the decision, we would just state that the language of Section 1988 in any action or proceeding to enforce a provision of sections, and among them 1983, that when the Maine Supreme Judicial Court made that determination on remand that this issue is going to be considered and that the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Awards Act is applicable in the state action, that we believe that gave finality to the present action, which was why we brought our writ at the time when we did.
Well, I'm not critical of you for filing a petition. After all, we granted it. But it just occurred to me that this isn't final, that attorney's fees may never be allowed.
Okay. As far as the 1983 question goes, though, we believe it to be final. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.